They pass through Butte, and the mountains become a toothy maw that surrounds them. The elevation steepens, and the cold makes the air feel thinner than it already is. In a narrow pass, the road has washed away entirely, replaced by trees and boulders that create a labyrinth of ice. The ground is angled steeply. Its snow-swept corridors cut this way and that way, and it is soon difficult to tell which direction she faces. At one point, she looks down at a slick floor of pure ice that mutters and cracks beneath her weight, and feels certain she is standing hundreds of feet in the air and might plummet through at any second, and maybe that would be for the best. Night comes. When they finally step out of the labyrinth and into the open pass again, a frigid wind roils over her and knocks her back a step before she presses on with her head down and her eyes watering and her tears freezing to her lashes. The road begins again, a white ribbon curling around the mountain. And here she finds a jackknifed semi. They climb inside, and the three of them fall asleep with their arms wrapped around each other, shuddering like old lovers. Her teeth won't stop chattering, a skeleton song, so she draws closer to Lewis, so close that her mouth is nearly at his ear. And she whispers, "I'm sorry," but he is sleeping and does not hear. They wake at dawn. The men are weak and sick. They are cold one minute, feverish the next. Every small movement brings a painful pulse to their foreheads. They limp along. They wear snowshoes that sink into the powder, snow collapsing onto them, burdening every footstep. Sometimes they pause for a minute or more to gather their strength before continuing on, making slow progress. They fall now and then. It takes longer and longer for them to get up each time. And then they don't get up. She does not go to them. She stands over them, wavering in the wind. It would be so easy to leave them there. Then she wouldn't have to see their faces when they realize her betrayal. Chapter 45. Ella lies in bed all day with the curtains drawn, nothing but shadows to keep her company. She tries to empty her mind, but her tongue always finds the swollen cavity at the back of her mouth. Probing it reminds her of Slade, his oniony smell, his pitted cheeks and slitted eyes, when he leaned into her, smashed her down, ripped out the tooth and held it aloft like a prize. Lewis once called her belligerently confident, but now she feels so weak and small. She wants to crawl in her own pocket and wither into lint. Not even Simon can help. This morning, when she wouldn't get out of bed, he nudged her and she said, "Leave me alone." "Is there anything I can do?" "Yes, leave me alone." He did, though she isn't sure she wanted him to. So many hours later, her stomach feels flattened with hunger and her mind warped with loneliness. She ought to feel excited by the knock at her bedroom door. But it's an anxious excitement, wanting and not wanting to be bothered. In response to the first knock and the second, she says nothing. Simon cracks the door, and light falls across her face and makes her flinch. He is carrying something toward her, setting it on the night table. Food, maybe, an offering. Without even knowing what it is, she feels both flattered and compelled to reject it. Then he yanks the curtains and lets in the painful sunlight. She props herself up on an elbow and squints at him. He remains a bit breathless from his climb up the stairs. His thin chest flutters beneath his shirt. He is smiling idiotically. "I brought you something."
"You mean you stole me something?"
"Same difference." She looks at the thing, a dented metal box with a handle and clasp, and says,
"What is it?"
"Oh, right." He fumbles with the clasp and swings open the top to reveal a dial and a turntable and an arm with a needle on it. "A portable record player." She plops her head back on her pillow and Simon's smile falls with her. "I thought it might cheer you up."
"Why would you think that?"
"Because it's a record player." His mouth gapes and quivers a moment before he finds more words to fill it. "For your record." She puzzles up her forehead. "The one you showed me? From your treasure box?"
Dream box.
That's it.
He darts to the closet and digs around and retrieves the vinyl record in a brittle paper sleeve with François Hardy scribbled across it.
I told you, my father used to have one of these.
He works the hand crank, grinding it in circles for a good 30 seconds.
That ought to do it.
Then he unsleeves the record and sets it two-handed on the turntable and drops the needle, and a rubbery scratch precedes the pop and syrup of the song.
This is called...
He studies the sleeve and shrugs and hands it to her.
Tous les garçons et les filles,
it reads. She does her best to pronounce it.
What does that mean, anyway?
I don't know, but it's nice.
It is nice.
He bobs his head dreamily along with the music.
Do you want to dance?
No.
She says it so quickly she must mean it.
Come on.
Can't lie in bed all day. We've got work to do, remember?
Then we don't have time to dance.
Just a quick one. Then we'll knock together our plan. Come on.
I don't know.
Won't take no for an answer.
I mean, I don't know how.
It's easy. You just move your feet.
He holds out the hand with the cast still coating it, the very thing that brought him to her, that brought them together.
Here, I'll show you.
Her hand is tucked under the pillow. She withdraws it now and hesitantly allows him to take it. He tugs her to her feet, and they stand opposite each other, with the husky, hurried voice of François Hardy filling the silence between them. Then Simon says,
"What Slade said to you? He's wrong."
She feels a jolt of pain, and her tongue goes automatically to the wound. They haven't spoken of what happened. She wouldn't allow it. She knew he felt angry and disgusted and fearful, just as she did.
But impotent, too.
He had wanted to do something. She had seen him in the doorway with his pocket knife out and waved him away with a no. His knife, no bigger than a finger, would have pricked a man like Slade no more than a bee sting. Now Simon puts one hand on her waist and holds out the other like an invitation she accepts. He pulls her one way, then another, and she allows him. Her feet feel clumsy, dragging a beat behind, but eventually they fall into a rocking rhythm.
He was wrong about love, I mean. Love is stronger. Love is why we don't give up. Love is the reason we're alive at all.
We?
People, I mean.
She wants to tell him to quit it already. She wants to drop her hands and plop back on the bed.
But she doesn't.
He chatters on, saying,
there's a lot of love out there. There's the love a mother feels for her son, which is different than the love a son feels for a mother. There's the love for a dog. There's the love for a painting. There's the love for a warm rain. There's the love for a song like this one.
She doesn't realize she's going to talk until she does.
There's love as infatuation and love that lasts into old age. There's angry love and pitying love.
He nods and shuffles his footing before finding his way again. She says,
what do you think is the best kind of love?
He thinks for a time and then says, when he was a child, he woke in the night and came out of his room to see his parents dancing with their eyes closed, turning in small circles. They looked like one person.
That seems like the best kind, I guess.
He clears his throat, and she smiles, and they continue to twirl around the room until the needle scratches off the record. Chapter 46. Lewis dreams about the ocean. The waves roll over black and foam red and rattle with bones. The seaweed is made of scalps, and the hermit crabs have embedded themselves in skulls that scuttle across dunes. Burr's voice beckons him, but to what? To this? Is this the end that awaits him? He wakes to the smell of wood smoke. His eyes snap open, but they might as well remain closed, as it takes him a moment to make sense of what he sees. The ceiling of stone, veined with shadow and firelight, not so different from the underlids of his eyes. His head still pounds with fever. Every thought burns. Then he understands. He is in a cave.
He can feel at once the coldness of the air and the heat of the fire beside him, but for the moment, he remains where he lies, dazed and studying the orange light playing across stone. The cave wall is crowded with faces, sketched with charcoal and painted with pigment. There are faces that smile and faces that frown, faces with their mouths rounded in fear or surprise. They seem to move in the firelight. They are crude enough to be anyone, and for a few minutes he imagines them as the faces left behind. His mother, Thomas, Clark. His world keeps shrinking, the company he keeps ever fewer. And where would his own face fit on this wall? It is then he notices another face, bigger than the rest, with horns and pointed ears and forked beard and swirling eyes and a snake's tongue, a face the others feared or worshipped, a stranger or a monster to all. He escapes his fever days and recalls his circumstances, his last memory of collapsing in the snow, and rolls over. Coulter and Joea sit huddled beside the fire. She is watching him. He feels unsettled by her gaze, owned by it. The darkness of it darker than he remembers, as if her eyes were black holes, matter with such force, such powerful gravity, not even light can escape them. "You saved us," he says. "That's one way of looking at it." "What's the other?" She shrugs. Coulter leans into the fire, his prosthetic arm extended. Its claw grips a cut of meat that cooks near the flames, the fat dripping into the coals with a sizzle. Lewis feels a sudden hunger and wonders aloud how long he has been asleep.
"Can't say," Coulter says. "Been in and out myself."
"Joea? How long?" "Days," she says, her voice monotone. "Weeks. I don't know. Does it even matter?"
Lewis shares a look with Coulter, who says,
"Don't take it personally. She's being real shit to me, too. I told her she should have left us to freeze, and she gave me a look that didn't exactly reassure me."
Joea tosses Lewis a canteen, tells him to drink, and he does, deeply. She offers him meat next, a venison chop, and he thanks her. There is a lidless, frightless intensity to her eyes.
"Don't thank me."
He doesn't know what to say to this, so he asks where the meat came from, and Coulter tells the story about how, a few hours ago, a deer wanders into the cave, stands before her, then kneels, and lays aside its neck for her to slit. He makes a knife of his hand, cuts the air. He pulls his own meat out of the fire, blows on it, says,
"Why couldn't you stop those bears from attacking us, huh?"
Her voice is surprisingly sharp, almost a yell, beyond the emotional range they've seen in her for some time.
"You think I didn't try? You think I wanted that to happen?"
They flinch as her voice echoes around the cave.
"I can only ask,"
she says through her teeth. Her face grows still again, impassive. Her eyes, glossy black pools, reflect the fire.
"I asked the deer. It answered."
"You asked," Lewis says, "and it trusted you. It followed you to slaughter." She gives him an almost imperceptible nod, and then whispers, "Yes." It is soon after this, as they push farther through the mountains, and the air begins to warm, and the snow thins to gray tatters, and green shoots spring from the muddy ground, that Lewis discovers the coffin-shaped box. Reed had the larger backpack, and after he shot himself, Lewis crushed together their supplies into one. There is a zippered interior pocket he has not noticed until this day, when he digs around for a needle and thread to sew a tear in the armpit of his long sleeve. The box is the length of his hand. He recognizes it as belonging to Reed, something he held often, almost like a charm. His thumb flips the lock. The lid swings open. He leans closer to see what waits inside it. Nothing but a shadow, it first appears. But then he tips it toward the sun and sees the vial, a long glass tube. There is a black, powdery substance inside. And when he tips it one way, then the other, the shadow comes to life, The label across it reads, Specimen, Live Virus, H3L1. He understands. The rest of the world blurs, and the box seems suddenly to gain weight, to bend his arm. He imagines the vial opened, the shadow within it escaping, its shape, the shape of the wind, ribboning and clouding outward, filling the air around him like 1,000 spores of rotten thistledown. He claps shut the lid. His first impulse is to bury it, erase it. But something stills his hand. His role as a curator, one who preserves the past, both the awful and the regular, and the memory of the burned-down villages, the heads on sticks, the blackened bones unpuzzled in the snow. Whatever and whoever awaits him at the end of the trail, the lingering worry that humanity isn't worth saving after all, and would be better off extinguished.
"What's the matter with you?" Coulter says. "You look like you've seen a ghost."
"Nothing," Lewis says, and hurries the box back into its secret pocket. Chapter 47. Fitted with backpacks and armed with compasses and clocks and lanterns, Simon and Ella worked their way through the sewers. His goal has always been to escape the city as quickly as possible, so he has never gone this way before, down a branching series of tunnels with centuries-old muck scalloping their bottom. They are looking for the basement entry to the dome, the one Danica told them about. It was left open as an escape route, she said. Every minute or so, they pause to listen. He wears a belt knife, Ella carries her baseball bat, and keeps it constantly raised. Whenever a rat scuttles by or a spider drops on her shoulder, she swallows a scream. And because this is his opportunity to prove himself, to show Ella that he is capable and good on his word as a thief, he pretends himself unafraid, puffing his chest and crushing spiders with his palm and telling her not to worry. Danica told him to wait until late night, early morning, when everyone slept soundly. That would be safest. Some of the ladders led to manholes and some to grates, but in the full dark, it is difficult to tell if they are cemented over unless Simon climbs up to them. He loses track of how many he tries until he finds what he believes to be the correct entry, a grate that opens into a dark room.
"I think this is it."
"You think?"
Ella says.
"What do you mean, you think?"
He cracked his cast off that day. It fell away like a shell, and he did not recognize the arm within, the stick thinness of it. The skin was yellowish and scraped away beneath his fingernail. His tendons and muscles ache from lack of use, and he finds it difficult to hold the lantern now while pushing up the grate with the other arm. The metal scuds across cement. He climbs up and knobs out a longer wick, and a room solidifies around him.
"Hmm,"
he says. From below, her voice.
"Hmm? What does that mean?"
"I don't think we're where we're supposed to be." There is a chair. That is the first thing he notices. A metal chair with straps dangling from each of its arms. He swings the lantern around him and knocks a chain that jangles and sways. A hook curls the bottom of it. There is a table along the wall and above it a wall of knives and barbed metal instruments he does not recognize. Then there are the mannequins, with hair and jewelry and whatever else glued to them. They appear like some demented child's attempt to cobble together a person. He feels breath against his neck and flinches. Ella comes up behind him with her lantern burning in her hand.
"Where are we?"
she says at a whisper.
"Not the dome."
They circle the room, working their way through the dummies but not touching them, as if they were strangers asleep. There is a bed against the wall. The blanket is thrown back, and Simon puts a hand to the pillow and finds it cold.
"Whoever lives here hasn't been home tonight."
"Why wouldn't he be home? With a curfew, where else could he be?"
"Doing something creepy, is my guess." Ella stands before a two-doored closet that takes up most of a wall. They each grab a knob. He steadies his breath, and his eyes drop momentarily to his lantern. Because of this, he cannot see as well as he could, his vision smeared with light, so that when they swing open the doors, he believes in the monster. The monster in the closet is real.
It swings out at them, a dark shape, a twisting bunch of shadows. He sees the hanger that holds it in place, the hollowed arms and legs with leather straps and metal buckles, a deputy's uniform. As massive as a tent. He runs his fingers along the fabric, and something pricks the pad of his finger. A drop of blood swells, and he brings it to his mouth to suck. It tastes like the air of this room, like the air of the morgue. He remembers the pallid face of his mother laid out on a slab. He remembers his father there, too. He remembers the breath of Ella when she sobbed and he clutched her after the tooth ripped from her mouth. He remembers the rage he felt then and now when he says, "Slade." Chapter 48. The doctor has a new name now. Mother. That's what the girls call her. She doesn't know what to think at first. They ask if it's all right, if she minds. And she licks her lips and blows out a breath full of emotion.
If that's what you'd like, I think Mother will suit me perfectly.
It would mean a lot to us, they say. It really would.
That settles it, then. Mother.
She rather likes the sound of it, and she, after all, calls them her girls, this den of young women she considers a kind of family. They helped her heal, and now she helps them build a life in Bismarck. They construct a greenhouse on the roof. From cellars, they harvest mushrooms and lichens and mosses. They dig up roots. They shovel through grain bins and discover preserved cores of corn and soybean to plant and to eat. They mash medicines, vitamins to ruddy their skin and harden their bones and battle the scurvy weakening them. She teaches them everything she knows about anything she knows. For some of them, that means simple reading. For others, basic surgery. Her injured arm, now scarred over, hangs useless at her side, good only for gripping the walking stick she uses to get about. She lost enough blood to permanently weary her heart. Her body feels shrunken, bent. But she gets by. Her girls keep her busy. Every morning they auger fresh holes in the river and bait their hooks with hunks of liver and drop their lines. By the time they snowshoe the banks and woods and fallen neighborhoods to check their traps, collecting into the back of their sleds the rabbits and beaver and otter and mink and porcupine, the tip-ups on the river have flared their fire-bright ribbons. There is no shortage of fish. The river surges with them, mostly carp, but plenty of catfish and bluegill and trout and smallmouth. Sometimes, on the coldest days, in an effort to stay warm, the fish swirl together beneath the water, coalescing like dark planets. And when this happens, the auger holes splutter, and the ice begins to thin and crack, and the girls move their tip-ups and find another stretch of river, because they have fallen through before, pulled away by the black current, lost. They don't see much of Clark. She ranges the outer reaches of Bismarck, the woods, sometimes hunting the plains, where she has shot elk and antelope, once a bison, whose herd departed in a thunder that shook the ground. The doctor is more grandmother than mother to them. They are by and large teenagers, except for Marie. No one knows how old she is, but she has gray in her hair, and her blind eye is as white and bulging as a boiled egg. She carries a phone everywhere she goes and mutters into it. The girls treat her kindly, but Clark seems to hate her.
It's that eye. It seems to probe you, see inside you.
One time, Marie removed the phone from her ear and held it out to Clark. The cord dangled like a vein.
It's for you, she said.
Yeah? Who is it?
Lewis,
she said.
It's Lewis.
Clark knocked the phone from her hand, and it went skittering across the floor. Sometimes the doctor sees Clark staring at the horizon. She doesn't ask, but she knows. She is thinking about Lewis. Something happened between them the doctor does not understand, and something has changed in Clark. Turned over inside her like a big black dog, and if the doctor reaches out a hand, she knows it will come away bloody. So she waits, hoping Clark will announce her problems when ready. But she doesn't. The optimism that once brightened her voice, the authority that once straightened her spine, is gone. The Clark she knows is gone. She disappears for days, returning with meat, or she drinks herself into unconsciousness, seeking that numbing burn that expands inside her, spreading to her toes and fingers, the tips of her ears, fuzzing over any thoughts that might bother her. Today the doctor finds her kneeling beside the fountain. Here the girls dump buckets of snow that island and melt into gray water for them to drink or wash their dishes and clothes. She splashes her face clean, rubs away what dirties her. She cups handfuls and handfuls to her face. Water was sacred in the sanctuary, and the old women were always talking about how it cleaned more than your skin, and even wetting your hands, your face, could chase away something that spoiled you. The doctor hopes so.
"Do you miss him?"
she says. Clark's face drips. The fountain's surface settles into a rippling mirror. A skylight wavers to life, a silver-shaped diamond that overwhelms her own reflection. Her face a mere pale smudge, barely recognizable, barely her. The doctor thinks she sees what Clark sees, a thing. When Clark widens her eyes, the thing widens its eyes, and when she opens her mouth, the thing seems to snarl and spring fangs. The doctor dashes a hand through the water, and when the image calms this time, it looks a little more like Clark. "There's a lot of men I miss," Clark says. "But my brother, most of all."
"You're not to blame for..."
"Shut up. Just shut up and leave me be. You might think you're there, Mother, but you're not mine." Chapter 49. It takes another hour, but Simon and Ella backtrack and discover where they took a wrong turn and follow the proper sewer channel and crawl into the dome's basement and discover there the thousands of oak and plastic barrels Danica promised. "Barrels and barrels and barrels," she said. "More than I've ever counted, and far more valuable than any wine. Enough to share. Enough to remedy the sanctuary's drought for many months. But my husband bathes in it instead." This is what Lewis alerted them to in his letter. A vast storeroom of water. The smell of mildew is a new one. Breathing is a little like drinking. Some of the barrels sweat and drip. Simon runs a hand across one and licks his palm. "Son of a bitch." Ella says they need to hurry. Dawn can't be far off. They heft one from a stack, wobbling under its weight and nearly dropping it with a crash, and then hitch it with two lengths of rope drawn from his backpack. They curl the ropes around a pillar and stand on the opposite side and keep their grip tight when they hand over hand lower the barrel into the dark. They climb down after it and drag the grate back into place. They do the best they can to secure the entry, threading the grate with a thin length of chain that they then knot around some piping below and anchor with a padlock. "Make sure there is no escape," Danica told them. "The dome should be watertight." They untie the barrel and tip it on its side. It sloshes and mutters, and Simon imagines taking a knife to it, sucking out a drink to ease his dry mouth. With one hand, they hold their lanterns, and with the other, they roll the barrel awkwardly along the sewer walkway, constantly readjusting their course. By the time they return to the museum, they are both covered in grime and sweat, bloodied, burned, red-faced. Simon drags the grate back over the sewer entry and then drags a box over the grate and sits down on it and puts his head in his hands and says, "Thank God that's done with."
"Oh, no,"
Ella says. He looks at her through his fingers.
"What?"
He is always the one making mistakes, falling off the ladder and breaking his arm, allowing Danica to surprise him with the dagger, climbing into the prison instead of the dome. A small part of him relishes the idea of Ella making an error, until he notices the way she backs away from him, with tiny steps and worry creasing her face.
"I'm so, so, so sorry."
"What?"
"I forgot my bat. At Slade's."
He lets his hands fall with relief.
"I'll steal you another one. You don't understand."
Her cheeks bunch up, her eyes glimmer with tears. She explains how Slade toyed with it when he searched the museum, threatened her with it.
"He knows it's mine. He'll know I've been there. He'll come for me."
Once again, Simon stands in the sewer at the bottom of a ladder. He has not had enough sleep. He has not had any breakfast. He felt excited and driven before, but that has given way to exhausted fearfulness. He studies the tunnels branching all around him. He feels about this place, the sanctuary, as he feels about the human mind. It seems contained, limited, and yet constantly opens into new corridors and closets, an endless vault, much of it dark. Ella gives him a nudge. Are you going, or am I going?
I'm going.
Slowly, he begins to climb. His feet ring against the rungs. His lantern dangles from his bad hand, a clumsy grip, and rust crumbles against the palm of the other as he pulls himself up. He reaches the top and threads his fingers through the grate, ready to shove it aside, when a key sounds in a lock and the door to the room opens. He keeps his fingers where they are, but swings the other arm out, bringing the lantern up against the sewer's ceiling, hoping to shield its light. Slay does not carry a lantern of his own, but the room, nonetheless, brightens, the residue of the hallway. The footsteps, slow, heavy, grind dust into the concrete. Simon's fingers must be visible, white, and rounding the grates like some cellar fungus, and he imagines a boot coming down on them, mashing them into the metal, clipping through bone. He fights the compulsion to pull back. A foot clunks down on the grate. Rust rains down on Simon, and because he turns his face away, he is for a moment unsure whether his fingers remain uninjured. And then the grate shifts again, loosened of weight, and the footsteps continue to the other side of the room. Simon already knows who it is, but he wants to see. He presses his face up against the grate to study Slade, a massive slab of a man. He wears his black uniform. The back of his head is lined with fleshy rolls. If he spots the bat, wherever it might be, Simon knows it is only a matter of seconds before he checks the grate. One of his hands rises. It carries a set of metal knuckles, bladed and rimed with blood. He hangs them from a peg like an ornament, and there they sway. He spins around and Simon ducks down and cringes as a footstep once more clatters the grate. All this while, his other arm trembles with the weight of the lantern. His wrist feels stabbed through with hornets, and he fears he might lose his grip altogether. When the door closes and the bolt turns, he drops his arm and nearly drops the lantern. Only then does he look for Ella. She has crept back in the tunnel and lowered the wick on her lantern so it gives off only a little light and makes her look small, 100 miles away. He waits a long minute, and then pushes aside the grate and pokes his head above the floor. The room is empty, for how long he doesn't know. He can see a crack of light under the door. The bat remains where it was, unnoticed by Slade, propped against the wall by the closet. He checks the door again, the ribbon of light beneath it, and sees no shadows in the hallway, no indication that anyone might be near. He wills his breathing to quiet, but his lungs cannot fill fast enough to satisfy his body. Across the room he pads, making no sound. He trades the lantern to his good hand and carries it before him, not wanting to set it down for fear he might forget something else in his haste. His free hand, his bad hand, closes around the bat. His grip is not good enough, ruined by the strain of the past few minutes. He makes it a few steps before the bat slips and falls with a clatter magnified by the concrete floor. He watches it roll in a long parabola, spinning with the slope of the floor toward the open grate. It catches briefly at the lip, and then falls through, into the dark square. A long second of silence passes. Then the bat hits the sewer floor with a dong and a rattle. Ella does not scream at him, call him a fool, but he knows she will. He can hear her voice call, "Hurry!" Can hear the bat scrape when she picks it up. And then he hears something else. Footsteps. The sound is more than a sound, it is a presence, powerful enough to be felt as well as heard. The very air seems to shake. He knows he cannot escape it. He does not have time to think. If he did, he would not do what he does next. He drags the grate back over the hole and crashes it in place. For a second he stares through the bars at Ella, far below him, her face oranged by her upheld lantern, but before she can question him, he is running for the door, snapping the lock, twisting the knob, yanking it open. There is only one way to save her, He must steal time, what may very well be his last act, as a thief. When Slade rounds the corner, Simon hurls the lantern at his face, and the big man raises an arm to swat it aside, but before he can, Simon has already dropped to the floor in a slide. Slade's legs are wide enough apart to shoot through, and once past them, the boy bounces up and into a hard run. All this before Slade knocks the lantern against the wall. The shattering matches the feeling inside Simon. This might be the one building in the sanctuary he has never visited, the police headquarters, and he can only guess which way he is going as he negotiates a series of dimly lit corridors. He enters a room of barred cells, and several men reach for him and rattle the bars and moan and cheer. One of them nearly snatches him, a raisin-faced man with black snot bubbling from his diseased gash of a nose. Simon makes it through one doorway, then another. He could turn this corner and just as easily find a closet, but his luck holds out. A stone staircase rises before him. Behind him, Slade does not bellow, does not scream or curse or growl. He merely pursues, all his noise invested in his movement, stomping his feet and crashing into walls and shoving through the doors Simon closes on him in his passing. They race up the stairs and out of the basement and down a tiled hallway framed by dark wood and festooned with old photos of policemen who watch them forbiddingly. Simon has never moved faster in his life. His feet hit the floor so hard pain rifles up his calves. The ceiling bulges upward into a meeting hall where the noise of his footsteps and the footsteps pursuing him multiplies. He races now toward the entry, where two deputies appear. They drop their hands to their machetes. They call out for him to stop, and he does, skidding, nearly falling. He does not bother turning around, knowing Slade can't be far behind, but he spies to his left the staircase that leads to the second level, and he hurries there. Another deputy appears on the landing, close enough to reach a hand and snatch his collar, but Simon twists from his grip, slipping off his shirt altogether and running bare-chested down a long hallway. He has no plan except to avoid the voices that pursue him. Halfway down the hallway, he pushes through the door of an office. He jumps onto the desk, shoves aside the chair, and worms his way out the window. The sill is spiked with nails and glass, but he does not have time to take care. He slices a finger, spikes his palm when swinging himself over. He tries to let go, but his hand won't loosen. His bad hand, it has been run through by a nail. He yanks at it, and the pain electrifies him, not from the nail, not yet, but the tendons twisting and snapping in his wrist. His legs dangle in the air, maybe 30 feet between him and the ground. He feels eyes on him. He hears voices in the street, a gathering crowd. In his mind, he calls up the vision of Ella, them dancing to the Francois Hardy record, and wishes her face to be the last thing he sees. But it is not. Another appears above him, like a risen moon. Slade is not smiling or frowning. His slitted eyes study Simon with a predatory fascination. Then he takes hold of his hand and pats it comfortingly before dragging it off the nail and letting go.
Chapter 50. As often as she can, Clark escapes the mall. Its imprisoning walls, its stale air laced with the tangy smell of fish and wood smoke, and surrounds herself instead with Sky. She spends her days hunting, minding the traps and lures, though she often finds herself distracted. Her eyes look west, her feet walk west, her body naturally angling in that direction like the point on a compass. She imagines now, as she did when a sentinel on the wall, mountains. White mountains that appear like teeth nested in black gums. Then she shakes her head or presses her fist to her eyes. If she thinks about the mountains, she thinks about Lewis. If she thinks about Lewis, she thinks about the final look he gave her, made of equal parts hate and sympathy, before escaping this place. So she works, and when she doesn't work, she drinks. That distracts her mind, numbs it, because when she starts to think, she starts to doubt and hate and grieve. The snow is ash, and ash is the color of grief. Everywhere she looks, outside and inside herself, she sees death. There was a time she felt nothing but disgust for Reed, but now she understands. He had it right. There is no such thing as the future.
The future is what you longed for. There is nothing left for her to long for except an end to the pain. Death is an end to the pain. Death is the future. Death is curative, medicinal. In her darkest, drunkest moments, instead of Oregon, she feels beckoned by the grave, a deep black hole where she might find her brother. She thought escaping the wall was freeing, but now death seems the ultimate freedom. She's sorry she pushed Reed away, and she's sorry she couldn't save her brother, and she's sorry she betrayed Lewis. She's so goddamn sorry, and though it's too late for the others, maybe it's not too late for him. If she could only find him, if she could only tell him how sorry she was, if she could only get that word out of her, she thinks she might feel better, like coughing up an infection. Today a warm front moves through, so that fog ghosts between the trees and flows down the river like a second current. The temperature hovers around freezing. Snow sloughs off roofs. The birds are busy, the red flashes of cardinals in the undergrowth, the black nets of crows thrown over trees. More seem to gather by the minute, and the air is busy with their muttering. She prefers to be alone, but the girls call for her this morning and ask her to help, and though she tries to resist them, they beg her, and she relents. They are collecting fish from the tip-ups, slitting their bellies and pulling out their guts to use in the shoreline traps, but they can't seem to reel in this one. It's stuck. Stuck, she says, and tests the line, and it hums with tension, and when she takes it in her hands, it feels like she has taken hold of herself, some central nerve that disappears into a dark place. She rears back, and the line drags, and she waits until it slackens, then reels in until it tightens again. And in this way, it takes her a good 5 minutes before the fish surfaces. She leans over to peer down the hole, more than a foot deep. At the bottom of it, a broad, whiskered, fleshy-lipped mouth gapes. A catfish. A big one. Too big. And she orders the girls to their knees to chip and saw away the ice to accommodate the girth of the massive fish. 20 minutes later, her arms ache from fighting the drag, and just in time she hauls out the fish, two-handed, grunting, and it slips and flops and twists on the ice. Snow sticks to it in clumps. It opens and closes its mouth, gaping around the hook. One of the girls gets her arms and legs around it, wrestling it down, and Clark drives a knife into its head, and it shudders and goes still. The girls laugh, and so does she. And the laughter feels strange, exotic, like a language she once knew, but forgot. The fog is beginning to burn away, and the sun seems brighter in the sky, even when filtered by clouds. The crows, thronging in the trees along the river, have been muttering all along, but now they grow wild, ca-ca-ca-king. When they cut open the fish's belly, they find a beaver inside, swallowed whole and socked by yellow jelly, like some malignant birth. Clark sits on the ice, for a moment too tired to care about the cold creeping through her pants, and everyone stands around her, commenting on the big fish and the beaver, saying gross and ick, and nudging each other and still laughing so that their breath clouds. Then the laughter dies, and there is only the cock of the birds. And something else, an under sound she can't quite place, like a drumming. The drumming of a death parade. She tells everyone to be quiet and creeps up the riverbank and peeks her head over the berm and sees the men. They are stomping toward Bismarck. They do not roar and brandish their weapons. They come silently, marching in straight lines that match the set of their mouths. Lewis once called her empathy proof, unable to appreciate any desire or despair outside her own. The girls have shared stories of their village, their families, the nightmare train that brought them here. But Clark hasn't listened, her ears plugged up with her own private pain. She has even seen the train wreck, way out on the plains, but never considered another engine might follow. It isn't until now that she understands, not only what they face, but what Lewis will face without her. With that understanding comes fear. Fear for the girls' lives, and fear for her own. And if she fears for her life, that means she values her life. If she values her life, that means she's willing to fight for it. Maybe there is such a thing as the future after all. She counts them, 30, no, 50, no, 70. As more slavers pour out of the fog, as if born of it. She turns to the girls then and tells them to hurry and gather their things. They must run for the mall. They must run for their lives. Chapter 51. The Pacific eats away at dunes and cliffs and the wreckage of towns built too close to the shore. Its waves battle in a great foaming collar, the current of the long fat snake of the Columbia River that oozes through the gorge dividing Oregon and Washington. And the rain, an acid rain that yellows leaves and spots skin and falls as many days as it does not. Water encourages life, but so does it promote decay. Birds break windows, hail breaks windows, branches break windows. The shingles on even the newest roofs last no more than 2 decades, and then split with ice dams, peel away with the wind, scrape away with branches. Leaves rot in gutters and plants sprout from them, the roots groping their way into the house. Mice and squirrels gnaw their way inside, termites and beetles too. Woodpeckers, no matter how it happens, as soon as a hole opens, water penetrates, bringing the mold and rust and rot that dissolve the wood chip subroofing and drop bricks and crack the foundation and make every building into a slowly collapsing planter box, furred over with moss and spangled with mushrooms. Fires start from lightning, from earthquakes cracking gas lines, but because the sewers have clogged, because water mains break, because fire hydrants crack, because basements have filled up like bathtubs, and because so much of the wood is rotten, they extinguish quickly. Winter comes and water freezes, thaws, and freezes, and in doing so, splits cement, crumbles asphalt, shoves around everything man-made that was once laid or stacked in a straight line. But not in Bellingham. Not in Walla Walla, or Corvallis, or Silverton. Not in many places, especially Astoria, Oregon, at the mouth of the Columbia River, where houses stand stubbornly against the attacking rain, where the roads run in clean lines, and where slaves arrive every few weeks. They cluster in wagons forged from pickup beds and drawn by oxen. They stumble in long lines, weeping and rattling, collared and cuffed by chains. They cram into rust-pocked cattle cars and boxcars dragged by steam engines. The slaves have numbers and letters branded into their skin. But so do they have names, at least among themselves. They have their own fenced-in shantytowns, their own families. They are tools. But even tools must be treated with some care or they will rust and break. They are told they are part of something bigger, a process of renewal. Some of the slaves work on construction, raising barns, repairing fallen chimneys, hammering together houses. Some of them farm, digging irrigation canals, hoeing and planting and reaping. Some grade roads, some repair train tracks, some log trees, and some mine for coal in the Powder River Basin. Some birth children. They are, all of them, building something. Something that extends as far east as Laramie, and as far south as Palo Alto. They are growing, and they will continue to grow, not just as a society, but as a species. There were 65 nuclear power plants in the United States. Their hot innards seeped through cracks and seams, and in Washington, along the Columbia River, there is Hanford, the most contaminated nuclear site in the country, storing 2/3 of America's high-level radioactive waste. Used nuclear fuel in waste dumps containing rods that give off heat and beta particles and gamma rays mutates into isotopes of americium and plutonium, making it a million times more radioactive than it was originally. When the facility was abandoned, the cooling ponds boiled over and evaporated. Exposed to the air, the waste ignited, creating a fire that clouds radiation into the air, spills it into the Columbia River, and to this day, continues to burn. The nearby reactors, in a state of meltdown, did not ignite when they overheated, They melted into radioactive lava that consumed the concrete and steel surrounding them, gelling into a massive silvery blob. Aaron Burr calls it the altar. So they call it the altar, because his word is their word. Astoria is close enough to the altar, and far enough away from it, kissed but not pummeled by the radiation. Some of them die of cancer. Some die of blood or respiratory disease, and some don't. Some are born with mere deformities, a face that looks melted, a second set of teeth barnacling their shoulder, cysts bulging and sacks of fluid dangling, moles so plentiful that a body appears like some fungus found in the forest. But others are special, gifted. Some are born with oversized eyes that can see a mile, see in the dark. Some are born walking on all fours and able to outrun any dog. Some can lift boulders. It is what makes them so special. Mutational genesis. Become the next. Evolve or face extinction. That is what he says. And they all do as he says. Chapter 52. Joea finds a river. The first canoe fills with water. The second floats. Coulter takes the stern, Lewis takes the bow, and she nests between two gunwales in the center of the vessel. Sometimes they are walled in by basalt and rushing along white-capped rapids, and sometimes the river broadens, and they can see far into hills dotted with sage. The world is not sand, and the world is not snow. There are green-leafed trees and green-grassed fields. For the first time, outside of a map, outside of a book, Lewis can see the world the way it was. An inhabitable, living thing. One night, in eastern Washington, Lewis slicks his cheeks with mud and shaves with a slow scrape of his knife. His beard falls away in white curls spotted with blood, and though the water runs cold, he bathes in it, scraping the grime off his body with handfuls of sand. Afterward, he feels better, tidier than he has in a long time. He is ready, and they are getting close. New wonders await every bend of the river, but the thrill of discovery has worn off. They have escaped the sand and the ice. They have found the new country promised to them. One goal has been satisfied. Another remains. They can travel to the very edge of the ocean, but Lewis will remain an unfinished map until Aaron Burr helps him find his compass. Birds shuttle through the air and snatch the bugs that fly in clouds above the river. The water glitters with stars. He thinks about all the leftover light, the memory of light millions of years old, light streaming from distant stars, soaking now into the river and into his eyes while colliding with light sent forth from the earth thousands of years before, so that in a way that time still exists, the energy of it still present somewhere. And eventually, he knows, because of the shape of space, it will return. The past will intersect with the future. Aaron Burr sent off his own message so many months ago, and now Lewis has come. Now their energies will finally collide. The river meets up with the wide, fat stream of the Columbia. They pass through a burning plain. The fire has spread for miles and walls them in with high flames and black smoke that makes them cough until they vomit. They portage the canoe around dams. Some are still solid, some cracked and seeping, and some split wide, gushing a white-collared rush of water. And then one night, to their north, they pass by the Hanford site, the storage center for nuclear waste, which Joea calls the altar.
The altar? Why do you call it the altar?
It's just what people call it.
Why do they call it that?
It works invisibly. It brings good things and bad things. It's like a god in that way.
What good things does it bring?
She regards him with her nightmare black eyes.
People? Like you and me?
The air feels almost palpable, as if you could pack it with your hands and take a bitter bite. And it burns to breathe, smelling like melted plastic. The throbbing glow of it blots out half the stars in the sky. They paddle swiftly, trying to get past this place as soon as they can, and it is then that dark shapes begin to knife past them and riffle the water. Lewis sees a pale set of eyes staring back from the place where he is about to place his paddle. In the gorge, along the Columbia, the river is dotted with islands, and all around them stacks of basalt rise like dried-out layer cake. Mount Hood looms in the distance, white-headed with snow and glowing at night. The lap lines of the floodwaters of millennia past stitch the canyon walls. Past the Dales, at Seven Mile Hill, a vast hillside of huge-headed sunflowers wobble in the wind. They travel through the day and all the next night, knowing the ocean is near, and before dawn they approach not a town, but a city. "This is it," Lewis says. "Isn't it? This is Astoria." It is lit with lights, like a net of stars dropped from the sky, lining the banks and rolling into black, humped hills. Lewis leans into his paddle, urging them forward, when Coulter says,
"Wayne."
"Wait?" Lewis says. "Wait what?" He feels a hurried need to get there, as if a sudden wind has risen inside him to hurry him these final few miles.
"I say we do this in the morning."
"Why? We're here." They raise their paddles, and the canoe lists sideways.
"Don't rush into things. I learned that from you. Remember?"
He opens and closes his prosthetic claw.
"I don't know what to expect, and neither are you. She's hiding something from us, that much we know."
"Joanna?" Lewis says. In the middle of the boat, she is curled into a ball. He says her name again, and she says, "I need to think." "What do you need to think about?"
"We're waiting until morning," Coulter says. "This isn't up for debate. Now paddle."
They keep their canoe to the far side of the Columbia, a safe distance. None of them say anything, for fear their voices will carry across the water. Joanna tightens her body, hugs her legs to her chest. A strange smell fills the air, briny, fishy, like the residue on his fingers in the hours after he guts a trout. Lewis hears something ahead of them, the distant growl of what turns out to be waves curling over, the river spilling into the surf. The ocean. The end. He stops paddling a moment, made dumb by the realization that after all these miles, all these months, so far and so long, his previous life impossibly distant, he has made it. A sense of accomplishment momentarily overwhelms whatever fears and questions bother him. He is in awe of himself and in awe of the ocean. He stills his paddle, transfixed by the sight of it. The chop rolls over. The moon is full and its white reflection smears the roiling water. A whole other universe exists beneath its surface. He can't see it, but he knows. The canoe is beginning to wobble, the current confused. The hills around them slump toward the ocean and fall away completely to reveal a fierce white light, flaring and then going dark, flaring and then going dark, like a great eye blinking in the night. "There!" he says, yelling over the surf. The vision he dreamed, the lighthouse that beckoned him, now realized. He feels so excited he might dive into the water and splash toward it. He leans into his paddle and realizes the canoe is turning away, steering them toward another section of shore. "You're going the wrong way," he twists around. "What are you doing?"
"Keeping us alive," Coulter says, and rips his paddle hard against the current. "You don't need me to tell you what happens to the moth that flies to the flame."
Chapter 53. They make a small fire out of driftwood at the base of a cliff, notched in by high walls of chalky orange clay. From here, Lewis cannot see the lighthouse, but it doesn't matter. Even with his eyes closed, the light burns bright in his mind. He hears a whispering. What could be the surf, but sounds like his name, said softly, a thousand times. He feels something almost tidal. Whatever drags the waves to the shore and crashes them against the sand, he feels, too. They try to engage with Joanna, but she refuses to answer their questions, and when Coulter grabs her by the wrist, she rips away from him and says, "Don't touch me." Her tone implies, this is more than a command. It is a threat. And Coulter takes a few steps back with his prosthetic held before him in defense. But Joea only stares at him long and hard before saying that she has to pee. Then she turns her back on them, walks from the campsite, from the circle of light thrown by the fire,